The Hermit by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 8. The old hermit stirred restlessly and shivered beneath the thin blanket. "I will enter the cave again," he said. "I am not used to being out in the open so much." The young monk, contemplating that amazing tale of a bygone age, came to alertness with a jerk. "Oh," he exclaimed, "the clouds are rising. Soon we shall be able to see." Carefully he took the old man by the hand and led him clear of the fire and into the cave, which was now clear of fog. "I must fetch fresh water and wood," said the young man. "When I return, we will have some tea, but I may be rather longer than usual, as I have to wander further abroad in search of wood." "We have used up all that which was near," he said ruefully. Leaving the cave, he piled the rest of the wood on the fire and scooped up the water can before setting off down the path. The clouds were lifting rapidly. A fresh wind was blowing, and even as the young monk looked, the clouds rose higher and revealed the mountain pass. So far, he could not see the small black dots, which would be the traders, nor could he distinguish fire smoke from drifting clouds. The traders were still resting, he thought, taking advantage of the enforced stop in order to catch up on sleep. No man could traverse the mountain passes during cloud falls. The dangers were too great. A false step would send man or beast thousands of feet down to rocky pinnacles far below. The young man thought of a quite recent accident when he was visiting a small lamasery at the foot of a cliff. The clouds were low, just above the lamasery roof. Suddenly there had come a slither of falling stones and a hoarse scream. There had come a shriek and a squishy thud, like a bag of wet barley being tossed on the ground. The young man had looked up to see a man's intestines looped over a rock some 12 feet above and still connected to the man, lying, dying on the ground. Another poor trader or traveler who was journeying when journeying should not be, he thought. The lake was still covered in fog, and the tops of the trees loomed ghostly and silver as the young man made his way forward. Ah, a great find! A whole tree branch had been ripped from the trunk by the storm. He peered through the thinning haze and decided that the tree had been struck by lightning during the storm. Branches were all around, and the tree trunk itself was split wide open. So near the cave, too, he thought. Gleefully, he grasped the largest branch he could manage and slowly dragged it back to the cave mouth. Journey after journey he made until he was so exhausted that he could manage no more. Wearily filling the can with water, he made his way back to the cave. Stopping only to put the water on to boil, he went in and spoke to the hermit. "A whole tree, venerable one! I have put the water on to boil, and after we have had tea and sampa, I will fetch much more wood before the traders come and burn the lot." The old hermit sadly replied, "There will be no sampa. Being unable to see and trying to help, I slipped and spilled all the barley. It now rests among the earth of our floor." With a gasp of dismay, the young man leaped to his feet and hurried to where he had left the barley. None was left. Falling to his hands and knees, he scrambled around at the base of the flat rock. Earth, sand, and barley were inextricably mixed. Nothing could be salvaged. Here was disaster. Slowly he rose to his feet and moved towards the hermit. A sudden thought sent him scurrying back. The tea brick, was that safe? Scattered lumps lay on the ground by the far side. The old man had knocked the brick over and then trodden it into the ground, except for these few lumps. Sadly, the young monk walked across to the older man. There is no more food, venerable one, and we have tea for this time only. We must hope that the traders come today, or we shall hunger. Hunger, replied the old one. Often I am without food for a week or more. We can still drink hot water. To one who has had nothing to drink but cold water during more than 60 years, hot water is a luxury. He was silent for a few moments and then added, Learn to endure hunger now. Learn fortitude now. Learn always to have a positive approach now, for during your life you will know hunger and suffering. They will be your constant companions. There are many who will harm you, many who will attempt to drag you down to their level. Only by a positive mind, always positive, will you survive and surmount all those trials and tribulations which inexorably will be yours. Now is the time to learn. Always is the time to practice what you learn now. So long as you have faith, so long as you are positive, then you can endure anything and can emerge triumphant over the worst assaults of the enemy. The young monk almost fainted with fright. All these illusions of impending calamity, all these forecasts of near doom to come, all these warnings and exhortations, was nothing happy and bright in the life he had to live? But then he remembered his teachings. This is the world of illusion. All life on this world is illusion. Here our great Over-Self sends its puppets that knowledge may be gained, that imagined difficulties may be overcome. The more precious the material, the more stringent the tests, and only faulty material fails. This is the world of illusion, where man himself is but a shadow, an extension in thought of the great Over-Self, which dwells elsewhere. Still, he thought glumly, they could be a bit more cheerful. But then, it is said that no man is given more than he can bear, and man himself chooses what task he shall perform, what tests he shall undergo. I must be mad, he said to himself, if I arranged this load of trouble for myself. The old hermit said, You have fresh bark on the branches you brought? Yes, venerable one, the tree was struck by lightning. Yesterday it was intact, replied the younger man. Then peel off the bark, strip the white lining from the dark outer skin, discard the latter, and place the white fibers in the boiling water. It makes a most nourishing food, although the taste is not ideal. Do we have any salt or borax or sugar left? No, sir, we have nothing except sufficient tea for this one drink. Then throw the tea in the can as well. But cheer up, we shall not starve. 3 or 4 days without food will merely increase your mental clarity. If things should become bad, you can easily go to the nearest hermitage for food. Glumly, the young monk set about the task of separating the layers of bark. The dark outer skin, coarse and rugged, helped to feed the flames. The smooth greenish-white underlayer, to be torn into shreds and stuffed into the now boiling water. Gloomily, he tossed in the last lump of tea and jumped high as a splash of boiling water scalded his wrist. Grasping a newly peeled stick, he prodded and stirred the mess in the can. With considerable apprehension, he withdrew the stick and tasted the end to which a few drops of the concoction adhered. His worst fears were speedily realized. The stuff tasted like hot nothingness, flavored with weak tea. The old hermit held out his bowl. "I can eat this. When I first came here, there was nothing else for me to eat. In those days, there were small trees right up to the entrance. I ate them. Eventually, people became aware of my presence, and most times since, I have had a supply of food. But I never worry if I have to remain without food for a week or 10 days. There's always water. What more can a man want?" Sitting in the gloom of the cave at the feet of the Venerable One, with the daylight growing stronger and stronger outside, the young monk thought that he had been sitting thus for a whole eternity. Learning, always learning. Fondly his thoughts turned to the flickering butter lamps of Lhasa, now in his mind almost a thing of the past. How long he had to remain was a matter of conjecture, until the old man had nothing more to tell him, he supposed. Until the old man had died and he had to dispose of the body? The thought sent a shiver of apprehension through him. How macabre, he thought, to be talking to a man and then, just an hour or so after, to be unraveling his intestines for the vultures, or pounding up his bones so that no fragments should be left unreturned to the earth. But the old man was ready. He cleared his throat, took a sip of water, and composed his limbs. "I was as a disembodied spirit, spiraling down to the great castle which housed the master of this supreme world," commenced the old hermit. "I was longing to see what manner of man commanded the respect and love of some of the most powerful worlds in existence. I was avid to determine what manner of man and woman could endure throughout the centuries, the master and his wife. But it was not to be. I was jerked as a small boy might jerk the cord of his kite. I was jerked away, backwards. This is sacred ground," said the voice very dourly. "This is not for ignorant natives. You are to see other things." And so it came about that I was towed many miles and then turned about and set upon a different path. Beneath me, the features of that world diminished, and the cities became even as the grains of sand upon a river bank. I rose into the air, and out of the air. I traveled where air was not. Eventually, there came in range of my vision a strange structure, the like of which I had never seen, the purpose of which I could not comprehend. Here, in the airless void, where I could not exist, save as a disembodied spirit, there floated a city of metal, kept aloft by some mysterious method quite beyond my power to discern. As I approached, the details became clearer, and I perceived that the city rested upon a land of metal, and covering its upper portions, there was a material which was clearer than glass, yet was not glass. Beneath that transparent sheen, I could observe people in the streets of the city, a city larger than the city of Lhasa. There were strange protuberances on some of the buildings, and it was one of the larger of the edifices that I found myself directed. "Here is a great observatory," said the voice within my brain, "an observatory from whence the birth of your world was witnessed, not by optical means, but by special rays which are beyond your comprehension. Within a few years, the people of your world will discover the science of radio. Radio in its highest development will be as the brain power of a lowly worm compared to the brain power of the most intelligent human. What we use here is far, far beyond this. Here the secrets of universes are probed, the surface of distant worlds watched, even as you now watch the surface of this satellite, and no distance, no matter how great, is a bar. We can look into temples, into places of play, and into homes." I approached yet more closely and feared for my safety as that clear barrier loomed large before me. I feared to crash into it and suffer lacerations, but then, before panic set in, I recollected that I was now as one of the spirits to whom even the most substantial walls were as shadows to be crossed at will. Slowly I sank through this glass-like substance and came upon the surface of that world which the voice had termed satellite. For a time I drifted hither and thither, trying to settle the turbulent thoughts within me. It was a shocking experience for an ignorant native of an undeveloped country in a backward world to endure and remain fairly sane. Softly, like a cloud drifting over a mountain range, or a moonbeam flitting silently over a lake, I began to drift sideways, away from the idle movements in which I had previously indulged. I moved sideways and filtered through strange walls of a material quite unknown to me. Even though I was even then as a spirit, yet there was some slight opposition to my passage, for I endured a tingling of my whole being and, for a time, a sensation that I was stuck in a tenacious bog, with a curious wrenching which seemed to shred my whole being. I left the constraining wall. As I did so, I had the strong impression of the voice saying, "He's got through. I thought for a time he wouldn't make it." But now I was through the wall and into an immense covered space. It was too large to be demeaned by the term room. Quite fantastic machines and apparatus stood about, things completely beyond my understanding. Yet the strangest things by far were the inhabitants of the enclosure. Very, very small humanoids busied themselves with things which I dimly understood to be instruments, while giants moved heavy packages from place to place and did the hard work for those who were too weak. "Here," said the voice in my brain, "we have a very great system. Small people make delicate adjustments and build small items. Large people do things more in keeping with their size and strength. Now move on. That imponderable force propelled me once again, so that I encountered and overcame yet another barrier to my progress. This was even harder to enter and leave. "That wall," murmured the voice, "is a death barrier. No one can enter or leave while in the flesh. Here is a very secret place. Here we look at all the worlds, and we detect immediately any warlike preparations. Look." I looked around me. For moments, that which was before me had no meaning. Then it got a grip on my reeling senses and concentrated. The walls around me were divided into rectangles about 6 feet long by about 5 feet high. Each was a living picture beneath which were strange symbols which I took to be writing. The pictures were amazing. Here was one in which a world was depicted as though seen from space. It was blue-green with strange white patches. With a great shock, I perceived that this was my own world, the world of my birth. A change in an adjacent picture drew my attention immediately. There was a deplorable sensation of falling as I gazed and I saw that I was watching a picture of my world as though I were falling onto it. The clouds cleared and I saw the whole outline of India and Tibet. No one told me that this was so, yet I knew it by instinct. The picture grew larger and larger. I saw Lhasa. I saw the highlands, and then I saw the volcanic crater. "But you are not here to see that," exclaimed the voice. "Look elsewhere." I looked about me and marveled anew at that which I saw. Here, on this picture, was the interior of a council chamber. Very important-looking individuals were in animated discussion. Voices were raised and hands, too. Papers were thrown about with a shocking disregard for decorum. On a raised dais, a man with a purple face was speaking frantically. Applause and condemnation, in about equal measure, greeted his remarks. It all reminded me of a meeting of Lord Abbots. I turned about. Everywhere were these living pictures. Everywhere these strange scenes, some in the most improbable colors. My body moved on into yet another room. Here were pictures of strange metal objects moving across the blackness of space. Blackness is not the word to use, for space here was speckled with points of lights of many colors, many of those colors previously quite unknown to me. "Spaceships in transit," said the voice. "We keep careful track of our traffic." Amazingly, a man's face leaped into life on a portion of the wall. He spoke, but I did not understand his words. He nodded his head and gestured as though he were talking face to face with the person. With a smile and gesture of farewell, the face vanished, and the wall frame was again a smooth gray sheet. Immediately it was replaced by a view as seen by a high-flying bird, a view of the world I had just left, the world which was the center of this vast empire. I looked down upon the great city, seeing it in utter realism, seeing the whole immense spread of it. The picture moved rapidly so that I was again looking down on that district wherein was the residence of the master of this great civilization. I saw the great walls and the strange exotic gardens in which the building was set. Saw, too, a beautiful lake with an island at its center. But the picture moved, cast thither and hither, sweeping the landscape as does a bird in search of prey. The picture halted, grew larger, focused on a metal object which was describing lazy circles and sinking towards the ground. The picture swelled so that only the metal object was shown. A man's face appeared and he was speaking, replying to an unknown question. A wave of greeting and the picture went blank. I moved not of my own volition. My directed mind left that strange room and entered another. Stranger. Here, at nine of these picture screens, sat nine old men. For a moment I stared in stupefied amazement. Then I began to chuckle, almost with hysteria. Here were nine old men, all bearded, all very similar in appearance, all of the gravest mien. In my poor brain, the angry voice thundered, "Silence, sacrilegious one! Here are the wise ones who control your destiny. Silence, I say, and show respect!" But the old wise men took no notice. Yet they were aware of my presence, for upon one screen there was a picture of me on earth, a picture of me surrounded by wires and tubes. Yet another picture showed me here, a most unnerving experience. Here, continued the voice in a kindlier tone, are the wise ones who have called for your presence. They are our wisest men, who for centuries have devoted themselves to the good of others. They work under the direction of the Master himself, who has lived even longer. Our purpose is to save your world, to save it from what threatens to be suicide, to save it from the utter pollution which follows a nuclear... Oh, but no matter. These are terms which have no meaning for you. Terms which as yet have not been invented on your world. Your world is about to have a fairly intense change. New things will be discovered. New weapons will be invented. Man will enter space within the next 100 years. Thus it is that we are interested. One of the wise ones did things with his hands, and the pictures changed. World after world flitted across the screens. People after people made their brief debut and vanished to be replaced by others. Strange glass bottles became luminous, and wriggling lines undulated across their exposed bottoms. Machines clattered and ejected long paper tapes, which curled into baskets placed near. Paper tapes covered with remarkable symbols. The whole affair was so far beyond my understanding that even now, after all these years of thinking about it, I still cannot discern the meaning of all I saw. And ever the old wise ones made notes on strips of paper or spoke into discs held near their mouths, and in response there would come a disembodied voice which spoke even as a man speaks, but the source of which I could not detect. At last, when my senses were reeling under the impact of such strange events, the voice in my brain said, "Of this you have seen sufficient. Now we will show you the past. To prepare you, I will tell you what you will experience. Then you will not be frightened." Frightened, I thought to myself. If he but knew, I am absolutely terrified. "First," resumed the voice, "you will experience blackness and some spinning. Then you will see what you think is this room. Actually, it will be as this room was millions of years ago by your time, but which is not so long by ours. Then you will see how, first, your universe was created, and then, later, how your world was born. How it was stocked with creatures, among them those we call man." The voice faded, and my consciousness with it. It is a disturbing sensation to be so summarily deprived of one's consciousness, to be robbed of a portion of one's lifespan, and not even know for how long one has been unconscious. I became aware of swirling gray fog which sent tendrils right into my brain. Intermittent glimpses of something tantalized me and added to my general frustration. Gradually, like a morning mist dissipating before the rays of the rising sun, my awareness, my lucidity, returned. Before me, the world became light. No, it was not the world, but the room in which I floated betwixt floor and ceiling, like a lazy puffball rising and falling in tranquil air. Like the incense clouds billowing in a temple, I lingered aloft and contemplated that which was before me. 9 old men, bearded, grave, intent upon their tasks. Were they the same? No, they were not. The room was different. The screens and the instruments were different. And the pictures were different. For a time there was no word spoken, no explanation of what all this portended. At last, one old man reached out and turned a knob. A screen lit up and showed stars, the pattern of which I had not seen before. The screen expanded until it filled the whole of my vision, until it appeared that I had a window on space. The illusion was so great that I had the feeling that I was in space without even a window. I stared at the cold, motionless stars shining with such an unfriendly, hard glare. "We will speed it up a millionfold," said the voice, "or you will not perceive anything in your lifetime." The stars began a rhythmic swinging about each other, about some unseen center. From an outer edge of the picture, there came speeding a vast comet with its flaming tail pointing toward that unseen dark center. Across the picture, the comet flew, drawing together behind it other worlds. At last, the comet collided with the cold, dead world which had been the center of that galaxy. Other worlds, drawn out of their predestined orbits by the increased gravity, raced on a collision course. On the instant when comet and dead world collided, the whole universe seemed to burst into flame. Whirling vortices of incandescent material were flung across space. Flaming gases engulfed nearby worlds, The whole universe, as seen in the screen before me, became a mass of brilliant, violent, flaming gas. Slowly, the intense brightness pervading the whole of space subsided. At last, there was a central flaming mass surrounded by smaller flaming masses. Gobbets of incandescent material were flung out as the great central mass vibrated and convulsed in the agony of the new conflagration. The voice broke into my chaotic thought. You are seeing in minutes that which took millions of years to evolve. We will change the picture. My whole vision was limited to the extent of the screen, and that which I now perceived was of the star system receding, so that I appeared to gaze from afar. The brightness of the central sun dimmed, yet it was still exceedingly bright. Worlds nearby still glowed red as they twisted and spun on their new orbits. At the speeded up rate at which I was being shown, the whole universe seemed to be in whirling motion, so that my very senses became bedazzled. Now the picture changed. Before me lay a great plain speckled with the immense buildings, some of which had strange projections spouting forth from their tops. Projections which seemed to me to be made of metal, bent into curious shapes. The reason for this was quite beyond my intellect to understand. Swarms of people of widely diverging shapes and sizes converged upon a truly remarkable object located at the center of the plain. It appeared to be a metallic tube of unimaginable size. The ends of the tube were less than the main girth and tapered rather to a point at one end and terminated in a rounded blob at the other. Protuberances extended at intervals from the main body, and as I stared intently, I could discern that these were transparent. Moving dots were inside, and my observation led me to believe that they were people. I judged that the whole building was about a mile in length, or rather more. Its purpose was quite unknown to me. I could not understand why a building should have such a remarkable shape. As I watched, intent on missing nothing, there swam into the picture a most remarkable vehicle, drawing behind it many platforms laden with boxes and bales sufficient, was my idle thought, to stock all the marketplaces of India. Yet, how could this be? All were floating in the air, as fish float and propel themselves in water. The strange device drew alongside the great tube, which was a building, and one after another, all the bales and boxes were drawn inside, so that the strange machine pulled away again, with empty platforms following. The stream of people entering the tube diminished to a trickle and then ceased. Sliding doors slid, and the tube was closed. Ah, I thought, it's a temple. They are showing me that they have a religion and temples. Satisfied with my own explanation, I let my attention flag. No words could describe my emotion as my gaze was jerked back to the picture. This great tubular building, about a mile long and about a sixth of a mile thick, suddenly rose into the air. It rose to about the height of our highest mountain, lingered there for a few seconds, and then vanished. One instant it was there, a sliver of silver hanging in the sky with colored lights of two or three suns playing upon it. Then, without even a flash, it was not there. I looked about me, looked at adjacent screens, and then I saw it. Here, upon a very long screen, perhaps 25 feet long, stars were whirling by so that they appeared merely as streaks of colored light. Apparently stationary in the center of the screen was the building which had just left this strange world. The speed of the passing stars increased until they formed an almost hypnotic blur. I turned away. A glare of light attracted my attention, and I looked again at the long screen. At the far edge, a light was appearing, forecasting the advent of a greater light, just as the sun sent rays over the mountain edge to foretell its approach. Quickly, the light grew until it was intolerably bright. A hand stretched out and twisted a knob. The light was reduced while leaving the picture clear. The great tube, a mere insignificant speck in the immensity of space, drew near the bright orb. It circled round, and then I was moved to another screen. For a moment I lost my orientation. I stared blankly at the picture before me, a picture of a large room wherein men and women dressed in what I now knew to be uniforms had their being. Some were sitting with hands on levers and knobs. Others were watching screens, even as I watched. One, who was more gorgeously attired than the others, paced around with his hands clasped behind his back. Frequently, he would stop his pacing and peer over another person's shoulder while he looked at some written notes or studied the wriggling lines which were manifested behind circles of glass. Then, with a nod, he would resume his pacing. At last, I chanced to do likewise. I glanced at a screen as a gorgeous one did. Here were flaming worlds. How many, I could not count, because the light dazzled me and the unaccustomed motion bewildered me. So far as I could guess, and guess alone, there were about 15 flaming gobbets encircling the great central mass which had given them birth. The tube building, which I now knew to be a spaceship, stopped, and much activity took place. Then, from the bottom of the ship, there appeared a great number of small ships, circular in shape. They scattered hither and thither, and with their departure, life aboard the great vessel resumed the even tenor of a well-ordered existence. Time passed, and eventually all the small disks returned to their parent ship and were taken aboard. Slowly the massive tube turned and sped like an affrighted animal through the reeling heavens. In the fullness of time, how long I could not say at all, travel was speeded up. The metal tube returned to its base. Men and women left it and entered buildings on the perimeter. Before me, the screen went gray. The shadowed room with the ever-moving screens upon the wall fascinated me beyond measure. Previously, I had been too intent upon one or two screens. Now, with those lying dead, inert before me, I had time to look about. Here were men of approximately my own size, the size that I should imply when I use the word human. They were of all colors, white, black, green, red, and yellow and brown. Perhaps 100 sat in strange form-fitting seats, which swayed and tipped with every movement. In rows, they sat at instruments ranged along the far wall. The 9 wise ones sat at a special table in the center of the room. Curiously, as I looked about me, the instruments and other appliances were so far removed from anything previous in my experience that I have no way in which they could be described. Flickering tubes containing a ghastly green light. Pulsing tubes of amber light. Walls which were walls, although they radiated the same color light as that out in the open. Glass circles behind, which points fluttered wildly or held rock steady at one point. Would that convey anything to you? One section of wall swung out suddenly to reveal a stupendous mass of wires and tubes. Climbing up and down those wires were small people about 18 inches high. Small people, festooned with belts containing shining implements, which were tools of some kind. A giant came in, carrying a large heavy box. He held it in place for a moment, while the small ones fastened the box at the back of the wall. Then the wall was swung shut, and the small ones went out with the giant. Here there was silence. Silence, save for a routine clicking and the shh, shh, as the tape moved endlessly from a machine orifice to a special receptacle. Here upon this screen, a strange, strange thing was depicted. At first I thought to gaze upon a rock, rough-hewed into human shape. Then, to my intense horror, I saw the thing move. A crude arm shape lifted, and I saw that it held a large sheet of some unknown material upon which was inscribed writing shapes. One could not say writing and let it go at that. It was so obviously alien that a special form of speech would have to be invented that it could be described. My gaze passed on. This was so far above me that it held no appeal or interest for me. I experienced only horror as I looked upon this travesty of humanity. But my wandering gaze stopped abruptly. Here were spirits, winged spirits. I became so fascinated that almost I crashed into the screen as I moved closer with the hope of seeing more. It was a picture of a wonderful garden in which winged creatures disported. Human in shape, both male and female, they wove an intricate aerial pattern in the golden sky above their garden. The voice broke in on my thoughts. Ah, so you're fascinated, eh? These are nameless ones to you, and they are able to fly only because they live in a world where the pull of gravity is very, very low. They cannot leave their own planet, for they are too fragile. Yet they have mighty and unsurpassed intelligence. But look about you at other screens. Soon you will see more of your own world's history. The scene changed before me. Changed deliberately, I suspected, so that I should see that which was desired for me to see. First there was the deep purple of space, and then an entirely blue world moved across from one edge until it occupied the center of the screen. The image grew larger until it filled the view completely. It grew larger still, and again I had the horrid impression of falling headfirst out of space. A most distressing experience. Beneath me, blue waves leaped and rolled. The world turned. Water, water, everywhere water. But one speck projected above the eternal waves. On the whole world, there was a plateau about the size of the Valley of Lhasa. On it, strange buildings loomed on the shore. Human figures flopped on the shore with their legs in the water. Other figures sat on rocks nearby. It was all mysterious, and none of it made sense to me. "Our forcing shed," said the voice, "where we raise the seed of a new race." End of chapter 8.